So last time we looked at the course of the gradual training, which begins with right view and the going forth, engaging in the holy life as we're doing for these 10 days, and to a lesser extent we'll be doing when we're off retreat. I feel confident that all of us here are committed to this, and so we take on ourselves a certain standard of ethical conduct, a certain restraint as part of our course of practice. What I didn't touch on last time, which is very important, actually the whole reason for engaging in the ethical conduct, is the refrain. The refrain that follows each of the components of the gradual training. And we touched upon it in the meditation exercise, the guided meditation exercise yesterday, but it's very important that we hear what has been said. A monk who is perfected in morality, or we who are perfected in morality, sees no danger from any side owing to his being restrained by the morality. Just as a duly anointed Khatiya king, having conquered his enemies, by that very fact sees no danger from any side, so the monk, on account of his morality, sees no danger anywhere. He experiences in himself the bliss that is blameless, that comes from maintaining the noble morality. In this way, monks, a practitioner is perfected in morality. So we have the proposition of following the moral precepts, and then we put them into practice. And when we put the moral discipline or any part of the gradual training into practice, and we're successful at it, joy arises, a bliss that is blameless. What we know intellectually, well and good. But if it's to transform us, if it's to give us insight, if it's to liberate us, what we know intellectually has to be translated to the heart. The heart doesn't speak a verbal language. The heart speaks the language of feeling. When we engage in a course of conduct that is beneficial, that is leading towards awakening, the way we know this is the bliss inside of us that is the result of our practice. This is what translates the intellectual knowledge to the heart and results in real transformative insight. The same occurs with regard to the sense restraint. When a monk develops the sense restraint successfully, he experiences within himself the blameless bliss that comes from maintaining the noble guarding of the faculties. So two bases for bliss. And it's very important, if we're having a hard time making contact with metta, to recall our purity, to recall the practice that we're doing, to recall the purity of guarding the senses and going inward and feeling the bliss that that brings, the freedom. It's always relative, right? We feel this bliss because out in the world, there are many demands on us, scattering our mind, scattering our attention, provoking in us unwholesome states, provoking in us wrong conduct, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood. But when we are free from that, we notice the relief. And putting the mind on that relief creates bliss. Even so, we have to remain mindful and fully aware. Now, this is very interesting. Bhante Ananda touched on it this morning, I thought, very well, when he said that when you are going about walking, sleeping, lying down, extending your limbs, eating, tasting, chewing, using the bathroom, whatever it is you're doing with the body, which is what the next part of the gradual training covers, you should be mindful. Mindful of metta. Mindful of loving kindness. There are two components to this section of the moral of the gradual training. There is sati, I'll use the Pali, sati, and there is sampajanya. Normally translated mindfulness and full awareness. It seems a little redundant. It's important that we realize the distinction. Sampajanya is just awareness. Bhikkhu Sajjato translates it, I think, very well as situational awareness, what is going on. So when we are walking across the room, we know we're walking across the room. When we're eating and we know we're eating, when we're speaking and we know we're speaking, when we're silent and we know we're silent, whatever it is that we are doing with the doors of action, even our thinking, our knowledge of that is awareness. Mindfulness is something different. Mindfulness comes from the verb sarati, to remember. And in the suttas, mindfulness is defined as recalling what was done and said long ago. And if we look at the Bhojanga Samyutta, the part of the canon dealing with the seven factors of awakening, mindfulness as an awakening factor is defined as mindfulness of the Dhamma, recalling the teaching. So, there is a process of actually recalling what we're supposed to do. There is a process of recalling the Dhamma and holding that in mind while we are aware of everything else that we're doing. If we are radiating loving kindness, staying with the spiritual friend, and using the six R's when needed, we are mindful. When we are just walking to our car or eating or doing any bodily activity, we are aware and we may not be mindful. We may be doing those things unmindfully. So there's a qualitative component to our awareness when mindfulness is present. And when mindfulness is not present, then we have what's called bare awareness. There's no such thing as bare mindfulness. Mindfulness is always recalling something and applying it to the present, making it in conjunction with whatever is going on in the present. Before I move on from that, are there any questions? Very important distinction, because of course there is a mindfulness movement. Just be where you are in what you're doing. That's actually an awareness movement. Mindfulness, again, involves recollection. Recollection even of an instruction. Recollection of doing the six R's. Bhante defines mindfulness as remembering to see how your attention moves from one thing to another. How your attention moves from one thing to another is explained by the process of dependent origination. There is contact, and then there is feeling. Pleasant, unpleasant, neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And then there's the reaction if we don't use the six R's. So we are seeing how it is that the mind has moved, reaction to contact, and we see how it is that the mind lets go, another movement using the six R's. Awareness is remembering to see that mind has moved. Not how mind has moved, that mind has moved. An important distinction.
The Buddhist terms for those two things?
Sati is mindfulness. I would prefer recollection or reflection. And then awareness or full awareness is sampajanya. Often found together in the suttas, but also found apart, which is how we can define the two separately. Okay. So with this mindfulness established, meaning our minds are rooted in the instruction, rooted in the teaching, and with full awareness, paying attention to what is going on with our body, speech, and mind, we may notice that hindrances arise. It's important to know which hindrance has arisen. Why? When the five hindrances arise for us, if we know that it's a hindrance, that is already a step to disidentification and letting it go. Oh, that's just a hindrance. It's not me, it's not the bad day, it's not somebody else causing the ill will and not being a good enough person. It's just ill will. It doesn't have to have a context. It's just a phenomena or a mental state. And so if we can identify that mental state or that phenomena quickly, that is a step, as I said, towards disidentification. Here, monks, a monk resorts to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, or a heap of straw. Just saying that the monk is now going to sit in meditation. Important because the monk is about to sit in meditation and deal with the hindrances. He's not going to sit in the meditation and go straight into jhana. So dealing with the hindrances is part of the meditative process. It's not samadhi, but it's part of the meditative process. On returning from alms round after his meal, he sits down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect, and establishing mindfulness before him. Now, the posture. It's not necessary to cross your legs, but it is necessary to have a straight spinal column. That allows the free flow of energy, and it balances the two energetic hindrances, which are sloth and torpor and restlessness. If we creep forward in our sitting, it's usually a sign that drowsiness, sloth, and torpor is coming upon us. If we are jumping out of our skin and pushing up, we might be a little bit too restless and need to pull back and relax. So we want to have a comfortably straight spine, shoulders relaxed, stomach relaxed completely. Nobody's looking, you don't have to suck it in. And just keep the spine comfortably straight, resting your whole body on the strength of the spine. You can set it and then you can forget it, and then make micro adjustments during the meditation to keep your spine at a place where sloth and torpor will not assail you. Abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness, often translated here as sensual desire. So wanting pleasures through the sense cords, wanting to see, wanting to hear, wanting to taste, wanting to smell, wanting to touch. It's going to be breakfast, it's going to be lunch. And having the mind assailed by the pleasant tactile sensation of the bed, right, and the nice covers that we're going to get into, wanting the pleasant visual sensation of looking at the beauty of nature. We guard the senses in order to restrain this covetousness that we all have and all will have until very late into the stage of this process. One step below full awakening, all of us have sensual desire and ill will. So we just need to get used to them being there and working with them. Abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Here the Buddha mentions the opposite of compassion is cruelty, which is a species of ill will. But if you genuinely see the suffering of another, if you are someone who has loving kindness, if you are somebody of a normal psychological disposition, the response to seeing suffering in another creature is love, compassion. Whether or not you do something to help that other creature, whatever steps you take, that is, of course, up to you. But your heart being moved by the suffering of others is the definition of compassion. Your heart rejoicing at the suffering of others is the definition of cruelty. And sometimes, we're all capable of that cruelty, but it sounds really ugly when you say the definition, when we think about that, right? Rejoicing at the suffering of others seems monstrous, but it's all in us. Again, this isn't about a perfection. This is a practice. We're practicing. We're not perfect. We need to recognize that we're not perfect. We need to recognize these things within us. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor. Percipient of light, mindful and fully aware, he purifies the mind from sloth and torpor. So this was the Buddha's advice to Mahamoggallana, who was nodding off in his meditation, becoming percipient of light. It may mean directing your head towards a light source, even with your eyes closed, and briefly making that your object of awareness to wake yourself up. It may mean actually opening your eyes and looking at light, not the sun, please, but some form of light to wake yourself up. Some people, especially who have good concentration or a tendency to good concentration, which is a karmic resultant, don't take it personally, can summon the light in their visual field at will. If you can do that, if when you notice you're meditating, you can make light appear. If you're feeling sloth and torpor, try and make that light appear for a few moments, then go back to the object of meditation. There are other ways of dealing with sloth and torpor if that doesn't work. Recalling the Dhamma, giving yourself a pep talk, life is short. It's going to be over before you know it. And being born as a human being with all senses intact and having access to the true Dhamma is a great rarity. Not just being born a human being, but being born a human being with all faculties intact and able to hear the Dhamma and practice it. A great rarity, so rare that the Buddha compared it to a blind turtle floating in the oceans of the world. And once every 100 years, it surfaces for air in the middle of a wooden yoke. That is the chance, that is the probability that the Buddha gave for us to be born just as we are now. If we just think of that, it sends chills through the spine. Another way of dealing with sloth and torpor, if that doesn't work, is to pinch your cheeks, pull your ear lobes, maybe even get up from the cushion and go for a walk, splashing cold water on your face. If you're moving off the meditation cushion to do these things, it means sloth and torpor is very, very heavy. So save those things as a last resort. And then the very last resort is to take a nap. Just to take the edge off the sloth and torpor, not for pleasure and indulgence. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated with a mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Restlessness is a hindrance that we will have all the way to full awakening. The feeling of wanting to jump out of one's skin, that's restlessness. Remorse is what we feel when we have misbehaved. And the Buddha said that fear of wrongdoing and a sense of shame are the guardians of the universe. They ensure that there is proper consequence to wrong action, to action that's harmful, that hurts yourself or others. And that resultant, that consequence, is a bad conscience. That's all you have to worry about with karma. You behave in an unskillful way, the resultant is a bad conscience. That's enough. Because so much of our spiritual progress, in fact, the entirety of our spiritual progress, depends upon a good conscience, a conscience being free from remorse. So when we are breaking precepts, when we are harming ourselves or others, when we are making bad karma, we are the ones who experience the resultant. I am heir to my karma, born to my karma. Whatever evil action I shall do, the results I will inherit. And the result is this remorse, this bad conscience. Those who don't feel a bad conscience at doing a bad action are people who are beyond the reach of the Dhamma. They do not have all faculties intact. Still human, but not able to practice the Dhamma, an unfortunate state. Abandoning doubt, he abides having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. He purifies his mind from doubt. So there are a couple of different kinds of doubt. There's doubt about Buddha Dhamma Sangha. There's doubt about whether or not Nibbana is possible. That's doubt as a fetter. This sort of doubt flows from that doubt as a fetter, but it's really confusion about what to do and about your ability to do it. Confusion about what wholesome states are. This is one of the reasons why it's important to know the dependent origination. It simplifies everything. When we have an unpleasant sensation arise, the natural course of action is to be averse to it and to be angry. And if we follow that course of nature, then we develop a mind of anger. And our future action is situated or biased by that anger. And we engage in future unwholesome conduct. And most people in the world, through no deliberate intention to do anyone harm, behave this way, get themselves into situations that are very difficult and don't know why they're in those situations. They have no agency. They have no free will. This is the teaching of free will. Free will begins at experiencing the feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and then saying pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, neutral feeling. It doesn't have to be elaborated beyond that. The next step, the craving, that's a choice. And the more we pay attention to our mind and the movement of our mind and our mind's tendency to jump and to grab and to push away at feeling, the more free will we have. And the more determination we can develop to become equanimous and to practice the teaching. So when we have known more about the teaching, when we know more about, for instance, dependent origination, how the mind develops, either to our benefit or to our detriment, when we know that process, we are purifying ourselves from doubt, from perplexity about wholesome states and how they arise. So the Buddha gives similes for these five hindrances. Monks, suppose a man were to take a loan and undertake business, and his business were to succeed so that he could repay all the money of the old loan, and there would remain enough extra to maintain a household. And on considering this, he would be glad and full of joy. That simile is a simile of being free from sensual desire. Sensual desire is compared to taking out a loan and having a creditor. Anybody who's been in that situation knows that the creditor comes calling for interest. All the sense contacts that we have may be nice in the beginning, may be fulfilling in the beginning, and then they're gone and we want more. And that's the call from the creditor. And how quickly we forget and how quickly we become dissatisfied, even though we were just fulfilled by a sense contact. If you were to try and recall all of the sense contacts you've had from the time you woke up to now, I bet you couldn't do it. I bet you could, by tomorrow, not even remember your favorite part of breakfast this morning. Most of you would not. Tell me the great meal that you had 2 weeks ago. No one can do it. That's because sense contacts are fleeting, and we're constantly looking for fulfilling them, and we are putting water and liquid into a bucket that has holes in it. And we have to constantly put in more water just to maintain our level of fulfillment. So if one becomes free of that state of dependency on the senses, one experiences the relief. 6R, the sensual desire, let it go. Spacious, gentle mind, free mind opens up, liberated mind for a moment opens up, and that's the basis of great joy. It is important to see that sense of relief and to be joyful because one is free. Or suppose a man were afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill, and his food would not agree with him, and his body had no strength. But later he would recover from that affliction, and his food would agree with him, and his body would regain strength. This is the simile for ill will. Ayakima liked to use a simile for ill will. She said ill will was like picking up hot coals and throwing them at someone. Whenever we're angry, the heat rises within, and it chokes off our airway, our throat becomes tight, we get a burning sensation. It's very unpleasant if we pay attention to it. But ill will has a poisoned root and a honeyed tip. We always think, if I just get it out, if I just say it, it'll be so sweet. Get that zinger in to defend myself, to really put someone in their place, to be right. That's the sweetness that we use to justify acts of ill will. We wouldn't normally harm ourselves, but there's this trick with ill will because we think it's going to be fulfilling. And then we do it and we feel even worse. We've made an enemy and then we spend a bunch of time worrying about that person's feelings towards us and how separate we are from them and what that person might think of us. It's a horrible hindrance. The Pugala Panyati Book of the Abhidhamma talks about people having tendencies, overall tendencies. It's said that some people have a tendency to ill will, some people have a tendency to greed, and some people have a tendency to confusion. That's their overall karmic makeup. But you know, we're constantly flowing and changing. In a few good retreats, and the ill will person might be the greed person. So things are constantly changing. But if you notice you're getting angry a lot, you know, you might say, hey, maybe this is an issue for me. I need to be extra aware and extra mindful when states of ill will are arising. Ill will sends out a forerunner. Before we actually think an angry thought or have ill will or speak ill will, that feeling of the bile, the burning, that comes up first. If we notice that, we should know that everything that we're going to do after that burning feeling, don't do it. Nothing good will come of it. Easily said, not easily done. This is a particularly damaging hindrance, particularly damaging to our ability to feel metta, the loving kindness. It really consumes metta. And that's the reason why forgiveness meditation is so powerful, because feeling slighted, feeling aggrieved, feeling that an injustice was done to you, holding on to that anger, holding on to that sense of injustice, blocks your metta. You have to let it go. You have to forgive it. Doesn't mean you have to approve. Forgiveness is not approval. The formula is recognize, change, no blame. That's all it is. Blame doesn't get you anywhere. So whoever hurt you in the past, you can forgive the conduct and move on. It doesn't mean you approve the conduct. That's a distinction. The Buddha is not morally neutral. There is good conduct and there is bad conduct. And good conduct has good resultants in our good sense of mind, our good conscience. And bad conduct has its resultant in our poor conscience, bad conscience. Okay. Or suppose a person were imprisoned in a prison house, but later that person would be released from prison, safe and secure with no loss to property. Then on considering this, they would be glad and full of joy. Harder to feel joy when sloth and torpor is gone, not as easy as when ill will is gone, for sure. But we should try and recognize the relief and experience the joy when we've overcome sloth and torpor. Or suppose a person were a slave, not self-dependent, but dependent on others, unable to go where one wants, but later he would be released from slavery, self-dependent, independent of others, a freed person able to go where they want. On considering this, one would be glad and full of joy. This is the simile for restlessness and remorse. Remorse is a karmic resultant of bad action. We can't avoid it. Not if we are a decent human being. We can't avoid feeling bad because we've acted wrongly. It's suffering. It's teaching us. This is dukkha as our teacher, our poor conscience. And it makes us a slave because we have this mindset, this mood, and it's very hard to break out of a mood that's set in. And if we have this darkened mood of remorse, we have to understand what it is, of course, that led to that as best we can, apply the six R's, but we may need to employ strategies to bring our mind back to a peaceful and loving place. So it's very important to stick close to the moral conduct, very important to guard the senses, because we don't want to get into a situation where we are filled with remorse. We don't want to get into a negative state of mind. Negative dhammas, negative phenomena, stray things, those will happen, right? But once we get into a negative state or any kind of state of mind, it's accumulated. It's our background frame for all experience. And it's harder to change that than it is to change whatever's happening in the moment.
Question about sloth and torpor. So of the hindrances, it seems like it could be like a different hindrance, at least in my mind, for I'm missing something, where it's like there's a physiological component, like are there different kinds of sloth and torpor where one would be a hindrance and one is not?
There can be a physical component. If you don't sleep, you're going to be tired. And so in the list of dealing with the hindrance of sloth and torpor that the Buddha gives to Mahamoggallana, the last one is, okay, this is your body. Go lay down. Not for pleasure, not for enjoyment. Just go lay down because your body is tired. And when the body is weary, the mind is far from concentration. Buddha found that out the hard way. So it can have a physical component. The psychological dullness has to do with not arousing enough energy, not being interested enough in what you're doing, not bringing up the resolution. Ayakema taught, when you sit down, resolve to stay on your object of meditation. Begin your meditation with that resolution. Set your determination, your aditana. Come back to that determination. Give yourself a pep talk. Remind yourself that life is short. Remind yourself that this time, even this time together, this opportunity to meditate together and to practice here is short. Engaging in what?
In contemplative practice.
Yes.
After intense manual labor. And I don't hear any, I'm not aware of any Buddhist teaching or traditions about using exercise creatively to as a complement to or in preparation for contemplative practice. I'm curious to know if there are any traditions or are any uses of exercise.
So there is, of course, the walking meditation, and there is the alms round that the monks go on, and it could be a long way indeed to the village from the monk's hermitage. That's part of it. We should remember that the Buddha is speaking here to the ideal setting for practice. And in the ideal setting for practice, the ideal mode of practice, ideal, one is a monastic. This still is useful to us as lay people, but the level of extra calories and extra bulk and extra entertainment and extra leisure that lay people have compared to monastics, there's a lot of fat there to be trimmed. And so the Buddha wasn't thinking about that because he was tailoring the gradual training to the monastics. So for us, certainly, there's a body-mind connection. And so strenuous activity to ward off sloth and torpor may be very, very helpful. I tend to think that part of the reason why in other traditions strenuous activity happens prior to contemplation is to generate the awakening factors, endorphins. Calms the mind, nothing clears the mind like a good run or something, you know? Gets you into that balanced, equanimous state after the body is flooded with pleasure. This is a cycle. This is the cycle of the seven factors of awakening. I'll talk about that cycle later. We're doing that with meditation and jhana. More effective, more reliable, more stable. You don't always get that when you go out on a run. Plus, there are flowers and animals to look at and phone calls to answer when you go out on a run that aren't there in meditation.
That was the exact thought I was having as you were answering. Are there retreats designed in which you go do 5 miles and then you come and do your jhana?
Running 5 miles and doing jhana, you will have already experienced the catharsis of pleasure that is the jhanas if you do that. So you will come back with your body already flooded with the opiates, the natural opiates and endorphins. Your mind will already be balanced and clear. If you come back and sit, you may be able to sit with that clarity, that equanimity directly. But the worry, though, is that you'll get tired because you've just depleted a lot of energy. But no, I've not heard of the workout monks, the workout path, the Gold's Gym way of liberation. Not heard of that.
I might add something that's welcome. Actually, for the joke of it, there's actually, it's in the Vinaya, that some monks would be worked out monks, but I just thought it's funny. because they have, there's a monk assigned in the Sangha to give the lodgings to different monks, and there's a story of this monk who's assigning lodgings for the meditators so they can meditate together, and then the teachers so that they can talk about their teaching, and then there's one group that is like, oh, these ones are like bodybuilders almost, or in the Vinaya, I guess. but one thing that comes to mind when I hear the comments is that I just think it's good to remember that this is at the time of the Buddha, and the time of the Buddha and now is, you know, it's very different. And coming back from India and Sri Lanka right now, even now, these our two cultures are very different. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Buddha didn't teach retreats. He taught, it was a more like a holistic way of life, and people would naturally go there and learn from him. And so this is kind of created, this has been created not too long ago, actually, these retreat environments, which allow ground for really good practice and all that. But in the West, I find we need this kind of support, because we don't live in a Buddhist culture, for example, where it's normal to see a monk for a bit, and then you invite him to your place, and he gives you a Dhamma talk kind of thing. There's no monks here, so, or there's very little. And so you have to come for a retreat. And the lifestyle at the time of the Buddha, you know, we live, because I hear the comment on the sloth and torpor and the activity, and this is really good, because at the time of the Buddha, there was no, life was very, very different. And so if you were tired, and if you were drowsy, then it's probably because you're just, I don't want to say anything culturally inappropriate, but there's difference in our cultures, and we in the West, we tend to be stressed, like way over stressed, like really, it's crazy, it's kind of, and that's like the level of tension we live with. And when we come on retreat, we're just tired because our bodies are tired. And it's normal to have sloth and torpor because you're tired. And that shouldn't be pushed through, that should be listened to, and you know, listen to your body. Then when you have enough energy, when the energy starts to pick up again, then there's another kind of sloth and torpor that is more like laziness. And if you're just lazy, then the Buddha gave these tricks, because at his time, I think that was more like, the last thing was like, okay, you're actually tired at the end. For you to be like that tired kind of thing. So, and cultures are different in their approach. Bhante Vimalaranse, I think, had to deal with that a lot, because he was teaching both in here. So his teaching style was very influenced by that. The other comment was activity, and Bhante would actually make us run up and down the stairs at Dhammasuka, like literally, like everybody would get to the point where 2-hour, 3-hour sits, he would make you go up and down the stairs. And I went to India, and one of the centers he used to teach there is like a 4-story building, and people say, yeah, Bhante, I'm pretty sure we would.
Yeah.
Because it actually, when we're stagnant for a really long time, like 3-4 hour sits, then the body really needs to be activated. And that's one of the reasons why Bhante's health is not that good right now, is he had really, really long sittings where he was told not to move for like 8 hours, like 2-year retreat, basically. And that created blood clots in his legs. And that's actually why he had gangrene in one of his legs. Mm-hmm. So it's actually really important, and it's not the goal. You shouldn't look for the physical activity as, you know, as the only way you can get that a spiritual experience. But it living in bodies, we need to also be mindful that these bodies need some level of care, and that one of that is some level of physical exercise. I wouldn't say bodybuilding or something.
What that level is, I think, is well encapsulated in the moderation on eating, where I will silence sensations due to hunger without arousing new sensations, right? So that's the balance. Give the body what it needs, but don't give it dessert. Don't indulge the body, just give it what it needs. We may go a little over because I do want to say something about the hindrances and how they arise in the meditation. The last simile, of course, paired by the Buddha to being lost in the desert without a map and in the end being overrun by bandits. Especially in the beginning when the instructions are new, our confidence in ourselves is not great, especially if this is our first time meditating. This doubt, am I doing it right? What are the instructions? Are the instructions right? Is this teacher any good? That's all doubt. Questioning your ability to accomplish the instructions, that's your mind resisting settling down. Just let it be 6R. It's actually very simple. The 6Rs, recognize, release, relax, re-smile, return to the object of meditation, and repeat as often as needed. As Bhante Vimalaramsi said, right effort will take you all the way to Nibbana. It's all that you need really to know. So the hindrances are not the only things that can arise in meditation. I don't have time to cover the Upakilesa Sutta, which I was going to cover today, but there are lots of other things that can arise that are not explicitly hindrances, like elation, different species of doubt. Sometimes these other sorts of hindrances, imperfections of mind, are related to the hindrances, and sometimes they're not. But what's important to know is that when things arise as a phenomena in your mind, to recognize it when it arises as a contact-producing feeling and to try and act right there rather than letting it hang around. Because phenomena that arrive through the senses are just phenomena, and they produce feelings. And if we deal with them at that point, they're easily dealt with. But if we don't deal with them, they continue through the cycle of dependent origination and they pollute our consciousness. So the sankharas are kind of the force carriers of our previous action, and they condition the next round of consciousness, the next consciousness that arises. So every consciousness that arises is not just pure consciousness. Only the enlightened one, the Arahant, has pure consciousness. The consciousness that arises is carrying its karmic history with it. But to get back to the meditation, hindrances arising in the meditation, it's said in TWIM that the hindrances are showing you where your attachments are, and the jhanas that we practice based on the suttas do not have the degree of, I hate to use the word strength, maybe concentration, where in the Visuddhimagga, for instance, hindrances would not arise. In the Visuddhimagga, hindrance and jhana are opposite things. You can have jhana, the collected or concentrated state of mind, samadhi, or you can have hindrances. In TWIM, you have these states of mind, jhana, based on the suttas, and then you can have hindrances arising, and you 6R and you let them go. So what's the deal? What's going on? Can the hindrances be there or can't they be there? Well, even if you read the suttas, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana. And it's also said that the hindrances are imperfections of mind that weaken wisdom. What gives there? Hindrances are showing us where our attachments are. Isn't working with the hindrance supposed to increase our wisdom, especially when we let it go and we see how it arose? I think the answer to this is actually in the Satipatthana Sutta. The hindrances are explicitly listed as phenomena of mind in the fourth foundation of mindfulness. For instance, I drop a book, it makes a sound, that's a phenomena. and then you have a feeling, and I don't like that sound, that is a phenomena of ill will. But that's not a mental state of ill will. That's just a phenomena of ill will. And so if we 6R that phenomena of ill will, of this book dropping, creating a sound, I'm trying to meditate, I don't like it, can't she be more careful? 6R, the phenomena goes away. That's the hindrance of ill will as a phenomena. But then there's mind affected by ill will, and that is in the third foundation of mindfulness. Mind affected by ill will, mind affected by sensual desire, mind affected by restlessness, contracted mind, distracted mind is mind affected by restlessness. You see the hindrances as states of mind in the third foundation of mindfulness. Jhana, samadhi, concentration, collectedness cannot coexist with a state of mind affected by lust, or a state of mind affected by hatred, or a contracted mind, or a distracted mind. Because in that same section of the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha talks about exalted mind, mind in jhana, unlimited mind, mind in the immaterial basis. These are represented as disjunctive, not conjunctive. We cannot be in the state of a hindrance, mind affected by lust, mind affected by ill will, contracted mind, which is sloth and torpor, distracted mind, which is mind affected by restlessness, confused mind, which is mind affected by doubt. We can't be in those states of mind and be in samadhi at the same time. So if we have let our reaction to sense contact become a state of mind, well, we have a hard time feeling the metta, don't we? We have to use the strategies to bring up metta. We have to 6R a lot, which is a good meditation because we are redirecting the mind at feeling over and over again and changing the overall state of mind, the tableau on which new contacts occur. Once we have overcome that state of mind, the state of mind affected by the hindrances, then the opposite can arise, the exalted mind, the unlimited mind, which are the minds in jhana and in the immaterial basis. So as a phenomena, as a stray dropped a book, I don't like it, 6R that, that's hindrance as a phenomena, very easily dealt with, or more easily dealt with. But hindrance is a state of mind, that's going to take more work, and it is not a state of mind that is compatible or can exist at the same time with jhana.
Just to make sure I understand, if that event happens, the ill will arises, it will fall, and I don't catch it, it starts building up and coloring my perception?
Yes.
Versus I immediately see when I go, it doesn't build up, and I have to work with the build up.
That's right.
Okay, great.
Right, yeah. And when you let it go, remember to notice the relief, feel joy, a little bit of joy in that. Yeah, it's important to juice the first jhana. Yes.
We talked about this a little bit better yesterday, but I want to make sure my understanding is correct. So later in the Satipatthana Sutta, mm-hmm. when he talks about what you're talking about, he says, he notes the arising of this state, and he notes the...
cessation? You want me to read
cessation
it?
Cessation of mm-hmm. the state, right? To me, that indicates 6Rs to me.
Yes.
Make sure I understand what you're teaching here. Bhante Nirvarasi always taught me, no matter what, it's 6R. So whether it's a hindrance coming up due to a broken precept in the past, or whether it's what you're saying is colors of mind, he would just tell me 6R. Is that the same advice you're giving here?
Yeah, certainly don't go looking for the origin of why you have ill will, but do look at this origin. If it's based on something in your history, you had a memory, a mind contact. It wasn't just hanging out in your history waiting to spring forward. You had a mind contact for whatever reason, and it produced a feeling, and you didn't see that that feeling or the reaction to that feeling was unwholesome. So it's not about going back and working with what your parents did to you as a child. That is a fool's errand, by the way. What you can do is you can say the memory of what my parents did to me as a child is here now. It's to contact like any other, just like dropping a book on the floor. It's unpleasant. I'm about to react to something unpleasant with aversion. 6R. Let go of that aversion. Doesn't matter. This is transpersonal psychology as opposed to personal psychology. It's all handled the same way. Contact arising at the sense basis, producing feeling. 6R before you crave.
Okay, so now would you sometimes recommend if this color of the mind is strong,
mm-hmm.
Bhante would sometimes recommend forgiveness meditation.
Yes.
Is that the same suggestion you would have?
What is the forgiveness meditation but causing the mind to make contact with a wholesome Dhamma, a wholesome mental object, producing a pleasant feeling, and delighting in that pleasant, wholesome feeling, rejoicing in it. Forgiveness meditation is just making the process of dependent origination work for you. We have to do it because we're stuck with it. There's nothing else we can do but work with independent origination. So we have to make it work for us. We have to use the apparatus that we have because of our previous karmas, because we exist. We can't use something that doesn't exist to help us with things that do exist. We have to use the materials on this shore to build the boat to carry us to the farther shore.
Just more questions. So what about feelings that are kind of ambiguous, like you can't tell, like maybe there's a slight coloring of being unpleasant, you're not quite sure if aversion is arising to that yet. Should mm-hmm. you like preemptively 6R and just 6R and don't worry about it? Or are there times where you should?
Here's the rule on 1 to 6R. You only 6R when whatever it is that has arisen, hindrance or not, has taken your mind wholly off the object of meditation. So you're going to be on the object of meditation and you're going to have some white noise going on in the background, thoughts or whatever, and things you can't really pick out. If it hasn't taken you off the object of meditation, even if it is a hindrance, right? If it hasn't pulled you off the object of meditation, then don't 6R.